Okay. I'm here. I'm an outsider, and I like to go to meetings where I almost don't know anybody at all. That's my favorite thing to do. So I'm pretty good, except I do know Seth. So I'd like to introduce you this morning to the Plant Science Research Network, which Seth has been involved with a little bit, and tell you how we view the future of graduate training. So I'm going to start by introducing the network that I run. I'm the PI of an NSF award that NSF has put about $1 million into this network. So it's a significant effort to bring together plant scientists, very large, to think about the future and how things need to change. And I'm going to divide it into two parts. First, an activity that we carried out last year to develop the future scenarios. So we had some basis for thinking about the way out future, and then how we use the futures to make specific proposals for changing how we train our future plant scientists. So the Plant Science Research Network falls under the Research Coordination Network, RCN, that you may have heard of, that NSF has. And this is a group of 14 professional societies. You can see them listed up here. The tri-societies were right in at the beginning, and we've added a number of members since. Now you notice it goes from ecology to genetics to molecular biology to agronomy, et cetera. It's a very broad grouping, and the goal of NSF, this came out of the Plant Genome Program, was the idea that to translate some of the very high-end bioinformatics and genomics into something useful for society, plant scientists across the spectrum really had to talk to each other and work together. So rather than going into our silos and having our own interest groups promoting one species or one methodology, all of the scientists get in the same room, and I ended up as the PI of this a little bit of an unruly coalition, but it's worked together very well under the principle of building consensus and listening to everybody, and the conversations are fabulous, and I've learned a lot about the different disciplines that fall in to plant science. So this Plant Science Research Network came out of a prior effort, a group of two plant summits that held by ASPB that came out with a document called the Decadal Vision. You can see a picture of it at the bottom, and I think I might have a hard copy in my bag. And this was a consensus view on a decadal view for plant science going out, as you can see, for 10 years from 2015 to 2025 in this case. We were inspired by the astronomers who all seemed to be able to agree on which telescope gets to be built next, even though everybody wants their own telescope. So if plant scientists could speak with one voice, maybe they'd get a better ear in Washington, and maybe there'd be more money going in to plant science. And the five major goals of the Decadal Vision are listed there, and the one that I've outlined is called Reimagining Training. And the diagram on the upper left is pulled from the report, and our main idea in this Decadal Vision was what we call T-training. And the long stem, the vertical stem of the T, is this disciplinary training. It's the research project, the breeding project. And the part across the top of the T is all of these professional skills that you've heard about in the prior two talks. So the idea is that a T-shaped professional or a T-trained student will not only be able to do what, let's say, the PI says they ought to do, but they in fact have a lot of transferable skills. Because remember, only about 15% of the jobs are in academia and 85% are elsewhere. So if we only train for future academicians, we're doing a disservice to the other 85% of the trainees. And in fact, many self-exclude from the whole training pathway because they don't want to be trained as if they wanted to go into academia. So this reimagining training, this T-training, was really more conceptual. It's only a couple of pages in the Decadal Vision document. And so the Plant Science Research Network wanted to turn that into a series of real proposals, actual programs. And so I need to introduce you to scenario thinking. If you've been involved in strategic planning, planning usually is on the left side is around a one future. So we say, well, we don't know what the future is, so let's just assume it's plus or minus 5 or 10% from today, and we make frankly an arbitrary decision about the future and plan towards it. And that doesn't serve anybody's purposes very well because the future is unpredictable. Anybody who's gone through the last, well, we all lived through the last election, didn't we? And living is maybe an exaggeration. It's kind of surviving, maybe. Anyway, scenario thinking says that the futures may be very, very different, and the farther out you go, the more different they may be, but let's prepare for all of them. Let's prepare for a range of futures rather than preparing for one future. And there's a whole science to scenario thinking. I'm not going to go through it all, but the main thing, the second thing, the one that's outlined there is called identifying forces of change. And we call those in scenario thinking, we call them the major uncertainties. What are the things that we know the least about that are the most important, in this case, for the future of plant science? And from understanding what is most uncertain and what is most important, one can build alternative worlds. And in our case, we built the worlds out to 2035. So those worlds are based on, again, these two uncertainties. And the two uncertainties in our group came out on the y-axis to be what we call the research environment, on the x-axis, what we call the driver of research. Now, the research environment, and you can read it there, it has two kind of extremes. One we call the expansive environment, where everything is there. We've got artificial intelligence, we've got money, we've got a nice infrastructure, we've got people who want to do science, and at the other end, yeah, it's kind of not a very popular career. The public's kind of against it, and there's no money, and so on and so forth. And I'm sure the no money part already rings true with a lot of people in this room. Now, on the x-axis, this is a really interesting one because it asks why we get out of bed in the morning to do science. And on the right side is kind of why I used to get out of bed to do science in the morning. It was the advancement, you know, the aha moment we're all waiting for. And in some of those worlds, advancement is really what drives folks to science. But on the other side is this need-based science or necessity science, where the only reason people get out of bed to do science is to solve a problem. Now, that's good for plant breeders, of course, and on the right side, it's bad for people who just like to have their head in the clouds. But, you know, again, we can't pick futures. The future is what it's going to be, and so preparing for the futures is independent of where you like them or not. And, in fact, elements of all of these futures are going to be in the actual future when it arrives. So we prepare for all of them and we adjust as we go along. Now, these four futures have certain aspects to them. So usually what everybody calls the good future is on the top right. This is one that's driven by advancement with lots of resources, so lots of discoveries, a lot of change. But on the left side at the top, we're really good at solving problems. The thing is that when we haven't seen a problem before, we don't have the foundation of knowledge to solve that problem. And so even if we have a lot of resources, if people only get out of bed to solve problems, then suddenly there's a new bug, there's a new disease. We don't know what it is. We haven't seen it before, and we lose out. And then on the bottom, where we have a fewer resources, we have to be more nimble. So if you look on the bottom right, nimble interdisciplinary science, there's a lot of robotics. So we heard about automation in the previous talk. And then on the bottom left is where we're kind of jumping from crisis to crisis, where, well, that may seem a little bit like reality today, where we kind of put Band-Aids on things. And again, what you see is when the futures are so different, the flexibility and adaptability of a scientist is going to be the key to being able to live in those different futures. And you saw the word adaptability in the previous talk. And each of these scenarios was illustrated by a young woman named Dakota. She always started in high school. She always ended up with a job in plant science. And I actually got tasked with writing these stories. It was a lot of fun. And I found out by following Dakota in these four worlds that in three of them she didn't get a PhD. She didn't need a PhD. So this got us to thinking about, you know, why are we so stuck in this, you know, thousand-year-old academic mindset where people go into a pipeline and they have to come out the other end or fail. And so where the PSRN has gone with training is to get rid of the pipeline idea. I don't mean a breeding pipeline. I mean like a training pipeline. And think about training in a very different way. And this happened through two subsequent workshops. So the top left, the orange, was the scenario development. And then we held a training workshop in October of 2016. Seth was at that one, right, I think? And there we used the scenarios in a group that was mostly faculty members, some deans and so on, to come out with some recommendations. And then we convinced NSF to fund us to repeat the experiment, which we did just actually last month in September. And we used there a group of trainees. We used undergraduates, graduates, and postdocs who applied to be present at the workshop. And those of us who were faculty-level people just served a coffee and took notes. So this was an amazing group, by the way. It gave me hope for the future. These young people just think so well, and they're so energetic, and they're so networked. It's just incredible. But they came up with the same recommendations as the faculty-dominated group had, which was really good news, but added a couple of others. And so now I'd like to share those recommendations with you. Okay, so the principles, it's really a trainee-centric mindset, because we've heard before about how when the PI calls the shots, the trainee comes in second and not first. And so this is training about the trainee, giving them greater independence but also responsibility. And that learning should be flexible and adaptable and also be decentralized. And there's a typo in this, so that's why the words don't make any sense. So learning should be flexible, adaptable, and decentralized. This idea of tethering someone to one organization, one institution, it makes little sense when people learn the way they do now all over the world through different kinds of media. And most importantly, that they're skilled in communication. That means communication to and from the public. It means communication between disciplines, understanding the values of different disciplines, how those people talk, how they think, and of course being able to explain their science, which is one thing we probably already do teach fairly well. And we need, again, to invite and include people from other kinds of backgrounds. And the trainee workshop came up with this idea of prioritizing trainee well-being. How many faculty members think about well-being of their trainees? It's actually very unusual. And their definition of well-being may not be the same as the trainee. And that's why a lot of people self-exclude from science. That's why we import most of our trainees from other countries, because Americans are smart enough to know they're not going to be treated well in training. It's considered to be, you know, what the PI went through is hard work and it was bad, and so it's going to be bad for you too. So how do we employ these trainee-centric principles? So in the top here of the circle, I have self-determination, the end fell off, and then at the bottom is this idea of modularity. Now, how do you give power to the trainee? Well, you fund them. You fund them directly. So our recommendation is, to the extent that it's possible, always fund the trainee. Give the money to the trainee and let them shop for the training they need. Don't give the money to the PI and force the student to come to whoever has the money. How do you give a trainee or a prospective trainee enough information to make smart choices? And this is the idea of having a mentoring team, not just the research mentor. So there's really a career counseling part of mentorship, and there's a scientific training part of mentorship. And we advocate, and we're actually doing this at Boyce Thompson right now, is to give trainees access to a mentor who is not invested in a grant or in a project that the trainee is going to have to spend all their time, and they're looking out for that trainee's future, whatever it might be, whether they're going to public policy, a foundation, industry, maybe academia in a few cases. Now it's useless to have modular training if you don't know what training you need. And we heard about a whole palette of skills that Dow thinks are important, and I think a lot of industry players think are important. So if a person knows they're going to industry, they know those skills are important, and maybe they can acquire them in an industry context through internships or training, but there are other ways to acquire them as well. But unless you know where you're headed, any road will take you there, right? So you need to know what skills to look for, and then they have to be made available. And then that cloud of accountability is around the mentor for delivering what the trainee needs, and it's around the trainee for making good use of that funding. And so we think that through awareness of careers, of the number of careers that are plant science careers that aren't academia and even may not be industry, that we'll get a broader participation of the population in this country. So the specific recommendations are listed here. I mentioned direct funding of trainees. I mentioned distributed mentoring teams. And I also want to call out individual development plans. There's an IDP site that AAAS created. These are plans that you create and follow so that you know where you are and where you're headed. It can include your research, but also your career development plan. And so this will help trainees understand what the possibilities are and what kind of training they need to acquire to make those possibilities into realities. I mentioned modular training. Modular training can be MOOCs, it can be internships, it can be a foreign country experience, but whatever it is, it needs to be credentialed. And if trainees are going to go around the academic system and get their training on the side, why should they have to go to a university if the training can be properly credentialed so that the future employer understands what that trainee knows and how they acquired that knowledge or that ability? Fourth, what we call seamless on and off ramps. This means that people who leave the workforce or the training path to raise a family, to take care of take care of a parent who's ailing, who want to make a career change, they can come back and go off and on to training as they need. Again, much more family friendly, maybe contributing to well-being of trainees. So that well-being and work-life balance, again, you'll bring a whole new coterie of people into science. And I mentioned already science communication. So what's in it for the plant breeding community? I think with IDPs, people understand the possibilities of going into plant breeding. Maybe that it involves marketing and engineering. Maybe they thought it was just farming. And again, to get those soft skills, that those transferable skills, the modularity is key to that. And again, getting people to join science who otherwise would self-exclude by making sure that their well-being is part of the training paradigm. So if we don't do anything, what will happen? And it wasn't hard to do a Google search and see headlines like this. So, you know, academia is a very old construct, and it resists change beautifully. And I hear about it in all the workshops. People know they have to change. They know academia has to change, and they're dragging their feet. But I think as we spread the power of decision around to the trainees and the trainers, I think it'll be a much richer and more appropriate world for whichever one of those futures may turn out to be the case. And I'll end there, and thank you very much for your attention.